If there was an active drug trade in Moscow, it was so new and so small that he hadn't stumbled across it yet. He made a mental note to check with Odessa, to see what, if anything, was happening down there along those lines. "And what people might they be?" the sergeant asked. If there was a growing distribution network in Moscow, he might as well learn about it. Nomori's job for Nippon Electric Company involved selling high-end desktop computers and peripherals. For him, that meant the PRC government, whose senior bureaucrats had to have the newest and best of everything, from cars to mistresses, paid for in all cases by the government, which in turn took its money from the people, whom the bureaucrats represented and protected to the best of their abilities. As in many things, the PRC could have bought American brands, but in this case it chose to purchase the slightly less expensive and less capable computers from Japan, in the same way that it preferred to buy Airbus airlines from the European maker rather than Boeing's from America. That had been a card played a few years before to teach the Americans a lesson. America had briefly resented it, then had quickly forgotten about it, in the way America seemed to handle all such slights, which was quite a contrast to the Chinese, who never forgot anything. When President Ryan had announced the reestablishment of their official recognition of the Republic of China government on Taiwan, the repercussions had thundered through the corridors of power in Beijing like the main shocks of a major earthquake. Nomori hadn't been here long enough yet to see the cold fury the move had generated, but the aftershocks were significant enough, and he'd heard echoes of it since his arrival in Beijing. The questions directed at himself were sometimes so direct and so demanding of an explanation that he'd momentarily wondered if his cover might have been blown, and his interlocutors had known that he was a CIA illegal field officer in the capital of the People's Republic of China, entirely without a diplomatic cover. But it hadn't been that. It was just a continuing echo of pure political rage. Paradoxically, the Chinese government was itself trying to shove that rage aside, because they too had to do business with the United States of America, now their number one trading partner, and the source of vast amounts of surplus cash, which their government needed to do the things which Nomori was tasked to find out about. And so here he was, in the outer office of one of the nation's senior officials. "Good day," he said, with a bow and a smile to the secretary. She worked for a senior minister named Fang Gan, he knew, whose office was close by. She was surprisingly well-dressed for a semi-ordinary worker, in a nation where fashion statements were limited to the color of the buttons one wore on the Mao jacket that was as much a part of the uniform of civilian government workers as was the gray-green wool of the soldiers of the People's Liberation Army. "Good day," the young lady said in reply. "Are you Nomori?" "Yes, and you are?" "Lian Ming," the secretary replied. An interesting name, Chester thought. Lian in Mandarin meant graceful willow. She was short, like most Chinese women, with a squarish face and dark eyes. Her least attractive feature was her hair, short and cut in a manner that harkened back to the worst of the 1950s in America, and then only for children in Appalachian trailer parks. For all that, it was a classically Chinese face in its ethnicity, and one much favored in this tradition-bound nation. The look in her eyes, at least, suggested intelligence and education. "You are here to discuss computers and printers," she said neutrally, having absorbed some of her boss's sense of importance and centrality of place in the universe. "Yes, I am. I think you will find our new pin matrix printer particularly appealing," And why is that? Ming asked. Do you speak English? Nomori asked, in that language. Certainly, Ming replied, in the same. Then it becomes simple to explain. If you transliterate Mandarin into English, the spelling, I mean, then the printer transposes into Mandarin ideographs automatically, like this, he explained, pulling a sheet of paper from his plastic folder and handing it to the secretary. We are also working on a laser printer system, which will be even smoother in its appearance. Ah, the secretary observed. The quality of the characters was superb, easily the equal of the monstrous typewriting machine that secretaries had to use for official documents, or else have them hand-printed and then further processed on copying machines, mainly Canons, also of Japanese manufacture. The process was time-consuming, tedious, and much hated by the secretarial staff. And what of inflection variations? Not a bad question, Nomori noted. The Chinese language was highly dependent on inflection. The tone with which a word was delivered determined its actual meaning from as many as 4 distinct options, and it was also a determining factor in which ideograph it designated in turn. Do the characters appear on the computer screen in that way as well? The secretary asked. They can, with just a click of the mouse, Nomori assured her. There may be a software problem insofar as you have to think simultaneously in 2 languages, he warned her with a smile. Ming laughed. Oh, we always do that here. Her teeth would have benefited from a good orthodontist, Nomori thought. But there weren't many of them in Beijing, along with the other bourgeois medical specialties, like reconstructive surgery. For all that, he'd gotten her to laugh, and that was something. Would you like to see me demonstrate our new capabilities? The CIA field officer asked. Sure, why not? She appeared a little disappointed that he wasn't able to do so right here and now. Excellent, but I will need you to authorize my bringing the hardware into the building. Your security people, you see. How did I forget that? He saw her ask herself, blinking rather hard in a mild self-rebuke. Better to set the hook all the way. Do you have the authority for that? Or must you consult someone more senior? The most vulnerable point in any communist bureaucrat was their sense of importance of place. A knowing smile. Oh, yes, I can authorize that on my own authority. A smile of his own. Excellent. I can be here with my equipment at, say, 10 in the morning. Good. The main entrance. They will be awaiting you. Thank you, Comrade Ming, Nomori said with his best officious short bow to the young secretary. And probably mistress to her minister, the field officer thought. This one had possibilities, but he'd have to be careful with her both for himself and for her, he thought to himself while waiting for the elevator. That's why Langley paid him so much, not counting the princely salary from Nippon Electric Company that was his to keep. He needed it to survive here. The price of living was bad enough for a Chinese. For a foreigner it was worse, because for foreigners everything was, had to be, special. The apartments were special, and almost certainly bugged. The food he bought in a special shop was more expensive. And Nomori didn't object to that, since it was also almost certainly healthier. China was what Nomori called a 30-foot country. Everything looked okay, even impressive, until you got within 30 feet of it. Then you saw that the parts didn't fit terribly well. He'd found it could be especially troublesome getting into an elevator, of all things. Dressed as he was in Western-made clothing, the Chinese thought of Japan as a Western country, which would have amused a lot of people, both in Japan and the West. He was immediately spotted as a Kwai, a foreign devil, even before people saw his face. When that happened, the looks changed, sometimes to mere curiosity, sometimes to outright hostility, because the Chinese weren't like the Japanese. They weren't trained as thoroughly to conceal their feelings. Or maybe they just didn't give a damn, the CIA officer thought behind his own blanked-out poker face. He'd learned the practice from his time in Tokyo, and learned it well, which explained both why he had a good job with NEC and why he'd never been burned in the field. The elevator ran smoothly enough, but somehow it just didn't feel right. Maybe it was, again, because the pieces didn't quite seem to fit together. Nomori hadn't had that feeling in Japan. For all their faults, the Japanese were competent engineers. The same was doubtless true of Taiwan. But Taiwan, like Japan, had a capitalist system which rewarded performance by giving it business and profits and comfortable salaries for the workers who turned out good work. The PRC was still learning how to do that. They exported a lot, but to this point the things exported were either fairly simple in design, like tennis shoes, or were manufactured mostly in strict accordance to standards established elsewhere, and then slavishly copied here in China, like electronic gadgets. This was already changing, of course. The Chinese people were as clever as any. And even communism could keep them down only so long. Yet the industrialists who were beginning to innovate and offer the world genuinely new products were treated by their government masters as, well, as unusually productive peasants at best. That was not a happy thought for the useful men who occasionally wondered over drinks why it was that they, the ones who brought wealth into their nation, were treated as unusually productive peasants, by the ones who deemed themselves the masters of their country and their culture. Nomori walked outside, toward his parked automobile, wondering how long that could last. This whole political and economic policy was schizophrenic, Nomori knew. Sooner or later, the industrialists would rise up and demand that they be given a voice in the political operation of their country. Perhaps, doubtless, such whispers had happened already. If so, word had gotten back to the whisperers that the tallest tree is quickly cut for lumber, and the well with the sweetest water is first to be drunk dry, and he who shouts too loudly is first to be silenced. So maybe the Chinese industrial leaders were just biding their time and looking around the rooms where they gathered, wondering which of their number would be the first to take the risk. And maybe he would be rewarded with fame and honor, and later memories of heroism. Or maybe, more likely, his family would be billed for the 7.62x39 cartridge needed to send him into the next life, which Buddha had promised, but which the government contemptuously denied. So they haven't made it public yet. That's a little odd, Ryan thought. It is, Ben Goodley agreed with a nod. Any idea why they're sitting on the news? No, sir. Unless somebody is hoping to cash in on it somehow. But exactly how? Cardsharp shrugged. Buy stock in Atlantic Richfield? Some mine machine builder? Or just buy options in some land in eastern Siberia, George Winston suggested. Not that such a thing is ever done by the honorable servants of the people. The president laughed hard enough that he had to set his coffee down. Certainly not in this administration, POTUS pointed out. One of the benefits the media had with Ryan's team was that so many of them were plutocrats of one magnitude or another, not working men. It was as if the media thought that money just appeared in the hands of some fortunate souls by way of miracle, or some unspoken and undiscovered criminal activity, but never by work. It was the oddest of political prejudices that wealth didn't come from work, but rather from something else, a something never really described, but always implied to be suspect. "Yeah, Jack," Winston said with a laugh of his own. "We've got enough that we can afford to be honest. Besides, who the hell needs an oil field or gold mine?" "Further developments on the size of either?" Goodley shook his head. "No, sir, the initial information is firming up nicely. Both discoveries are big. The oil especially, but the gold as well." "The gold thing will distort the market somewhat," Sectrez opined. "Depending on how fast it comes on stream. It might also cause a shutdown of the mine we have operating in the Dakotas." "Why?" Goodley asked. "If the Russian strike is as good as the data suggests, they'll be producing gold for about 25% less than what it costs there, despite environmental conditions. The attendant reduction of the world price of gold will then make Dakota unprofitable to operate." Winston shrugged. "So they'll mothball the site and sit until the price goes back up. Probably after the initial flurry of production, our Russian friends will scale things back so that they can cash in a more, orderly way. What'll happen is that the other producers, mainly South Africans, will meet with them and offer advice on how to exploit that find more efficiently. Usually, the new kids listen to advice from the old guys. The Russians have coordinated diamond production with the De Beers people for a long time, back to when the country was called the Soviet Union. Business is business, even for commies. So, you're going to offer our help to our friends in Moscow?" Trader asked Swordsman. Ryan shook his head. "I can't yet. I can't let them know that we know. Sergei Nikolaevich would start wondering how, and he'd probably come up with SIGINT, and that's a method of gathering information that we try to keep covert." Probably a waste of time, Ryan knew, but the game had rules, and everyone played by those rules. Golovko could guess at Signal's intelligence, but he'd never quite know. "I'll probably never stop being a spook," the president admitted to himself. Keeping and guarding secrets was one of the things that came so easily to him. A little too easily, Arnie Van Dam often warned. A modern democratic government was supposed to be more open, like a torn curtain on the bedroom window that allowed people to look in whenever they wished. That was an idea Ryan had never grown to appreciate. He was the one who decided what people were allowed to know and when they'd know it. It was a point of view he followed even when he knew it to be wrong, for no other reason than it was how he'd learned government service at the knee of an admiral named James Greer. Old habits were hard to break. "I'll call Sam Sherman at Atlantic Richfield," Winston suggested. "If he breaks it to me, then it's in the open, or at least open enough." "Can we trust him?" Winston nodded. "Sam plays by the rules. We can't ask him to screw over his own board, but he knows what flag to salute, Jack." "Okay, George, a discreet inquiry." "Yes, sir, Mr. President, sir." "God damn it, George!" "Jack, when the hell are you going to learn to relax in this fucking job?" Sectrez asked POTUS. "The day I move out of this goddamned museum and become a free man again," Ryan replied with a submissive nod. Winston was right. He had to learn to stay on a more even keel in the office of president. In addition to not being helpful to himself, it wasn't especially helpful to the country for him to be jumpy with the falderal of office holding. That also made it easy for people like the Secretary of the Treasury to twist his tail, and George Winston was one of the people who enjoyed doing that. Maybe because it ultimately helped him relax, Ryan thought. Backwards English on the ball or something. George, why do you think I should relax in this job? Jack, because you're here to be effective. And being tight all the time does not make you more effective. Kick back, guy, maybe even learn to like some aspect of it. Like what? Hell. Winston shrugged, and then nodded to the secretary's office. Lots of cute young interns out there. There's been enough of that, Ryan said crossly. Then he did manage to relax and smile a little. Besides, I'm married to a surgeon. Make that little mistake, and I could wake up without something important. Yeah, I suppose it's bad for the country to have the president's dick cut off, eh? People might not respect us anymore. Winston stood. Gotta go back across the street and look at some economic models. Economy looking good? POTUS asked. No complaints from me or Mark Gant. Just so the Fed chairman leaves the discount rate alone, but I expect he will. Inflation is pretty flat, and there's no upward pressure anywhere that I see happening. Ben? Goodley looked through his notes, as though he'd forgotten something. Oh, yeah. Would you believe the Vatican is appointing a papal nuncio to the PRC? Oh, what's that mean exactly? Winston asked, stopping halfway to the door. The nuncio is essentially an ambassador. People forget that the Vatican is a nation-state in its own right and has the usual trappings of statehood. That includes diplomatic representation. A nuncio is just that, an ambassador. And a spook, Ryan added. Really? Winston asked. George, the Vatican has the world's oldest intelligence service. Goes back centuries. And, yeah, the nuncio gathers information and forwards it to the Home Office, because people talk to him. Who better to talk to than a priest, right? They're good enough at gathering information that we've made the occasional effort to crack their communications. Back in the 30s, a senior crippy at the State Department resigned over it, Ryan informed his secretaries, reverting back to history teacher. We still do that? Winston directed this question at Goodley, the president's national security advisor. Goodley looked first to Ryan and got a nod. Yes, sir. Fort Meade still takes a look at their messages. Their ciphers are a little old-fashioned, and we can brute-force them. And ours? The current standard is called tap dance. It's totally random, and therefore it's theoretically unbreakable. Unless somebody screws up and reuses a segment of it. But with approximately 647 million transpositions on every daily CD-ROM diskette, that's not very likely. What about the phone systems? The stew? Goodley asked, getting a nod. That's computer-based, with a 256K computer-generated encryption key. It can be broken, but you need a computer, the right algorithm, and a couple of weeks at least, and the shorter the message, the harder it is to crack it, instead of the other way around. The guys at Fort Meade are playing with using quantum physics equations to crack ciphers, and evidently they're having some success. But if you want an explanation, you're going to have to ask somebody else. I didn't even pretend to listen, Goodley admitted. It's so far over my head I can't even see the bottom of it. Yeah, get your friend Gant involved, Ryan suggested. He seems to know pewters pretty well. As a matter of fact, you might want to get him briefed in on these developments in Russia. Maybe he can model the effects they'll have on the Russian economy. Only if everyone plays by the rules, Winston said in warning. If they follow the corruption that's been gutting their economy the last few years, you just can't predict anything, Jack. We cannot let it happen again, Comrade President, Sergei Nikolaevich said over a half-empty glass of vodka. This was still the best in the world, if the only such Russian product of which he could make that boast. That thought generated an angry frown at what his nation had become. Sergei Nikolaevich, what do you propose? Comrade President, these two discoveries are a gift from heaven itself. If we utilize them properly, we can transform our country, or at least make a proper beginning at doing that. The earnings in hard currencies will be colossal, and we can use that money to rebuild so much of our infrastructure that we can transform our economy. If, that is, he held up a cautionary finger, if we don't allow a thieving few to take the money and bank it in Geneva or Liechtenstein. It does us no good there, Comrade President. Golovko didn't add that a few people, a few well-placed individuals, would profit substantially from this. He didn't even add that he himself would be one of them, and so would his president. It was just too much to ask any man to walk away from such an opportunity. Integrity was a virtue best found among those to afford it, and the press be damned, the career intelligence officer thought. What had they ever done for his country or any other? All they did was expose the honest work of some and the dishonest work of others, doing little actual work themselves. And besides, they were as easily bribed as anyone else, weren't they? And so who gets the concession to exploit these resources? The Russian president asked. In the case of the oil, our own exploration company, plus the American company, Atlantic Richfield. They have the most experience in producing oil in those environmental conditions anyway, and our people have much to learn from them. I would propose a fee-for-service arrangement, a generous one, but not an ownership percentage in the oil field itself. The exploration contract was along those lines, generous in absolute terms, but no share at all in the fields discovered.
And the gold strike?
Easier still. No foreigners were involved in that discovery at all. Comrade Gogol will have an interest in the discovery, of course, but he is an old man with no heirs, and, it would seem, a man of the simplest tastes. A properly heated hut and a new hunting rifle will probably make him very happy, from what these reports tell us.
And the value of this venture?
Upwards of 70 billions. And all we need do is purchase some special equipment, the best of which comes from the American company Caterpillar.
Is that necessary, Sergei?
Comrade President, the Americans are our friends, after a fashion, and it will not hurt us to remain on good terms with their president. And besides, their heavy equipment is the world's finest.
Better than the Japanese?
For these purposes, yes, but slightly more expensive, Golovko answered, thinking that people really were all the same. And despite the education of his youth, in every man there seemed to be a capitalist, looking for ways to cut costs and increase his profits, often to the point of forgetting the larger issues. Well, that was why Golovko was here, wasn't it?
And who will want the money?
A rare chuckle in this office.
Comrade President, everyone wants to have money. In realistic terms, our military will be at the front of the line.
Of course, the Russian president agreed, with a resigned sigh. They usually are.
Oh, any progress in the attack on your car? He asked, looking up from his briefing papers.
Golovko shook his head.
No notable progress, no. The current thinking is that this Avseyenko fellow was the actual target, and the automobile was just a coincidence. The militia continues to investigate.
Keep me posted, will you?
Of course, Comrade President.
Chapter 5. Headlines. Sam Sherman was one of those whom age hadn't treated kindly. though he himself hadn't helped. An avid golfer, he moved from lie to lie via cart. He was much too overweight to walk more than a few hundred yards in a day. It was rather sad for one who'd been a first-string guard for the Princeton Tigers once upon a time. Well, Winston thought, muscle just turned to blubber if you didn't use it properly. But the overweight body didn't detract from the sharpness of his brain. Sherman had graduated about fifth in a class not replete with dummies, double majoring in geology and business. He'd followed up the first sheet of parchment with a Harvard MBA and a Ph.D. from the University of Texas, this one in geology as well. And so Samuel Price Sherman could not only talk rocks with the explorers, but finance with his board members. And that was one of the reasons why Atlantic Richfield stock was as healthy as any oil issue in the known world. His face was lined by a lot of low sun and field grit, and his belly swollen by a lot of beers with the roughnecks out in many godforsaken places, plus hot dogs and other junk food preferred by the men who drifted into such employment. Winston was surprised that Sam didn't smoke, too. Then he spotted the box on the man's desk. Cigars. Probably good ones. Sherman could afford the best, but he still had the Ivy League manners not to light up in front of a guest who might be offended by the blue cloud they generated. Atlantic Richfield's home office was elsewhere, but as with most major corporations, it didn't hurt to have a set of offices in Washington, the better to influence members of Congress with the occasional lavish party. Sherman's personal office was in a corner on the top floor, and plush enough, with a thick beige carpet. The desk was either mahogany or well-seasoned oak, polished like glass, and probably cost more than his secretary made in a year or two.
"So, how do you like working for the government, George?"
"It's really a fun change of pace. Now I can play with all the things I used to bitch about. So I guess I've kind of given up my right to bitch."
"That is a major sacrifice, buddy," Sherman replied with a laugh. "It's kind of like going over to the enemy, isn't it?"
"Well, sometimes you gotta pay back, Sam, and making policy the right way can be diverting."
"Well, I have no complaints with what you guys are doing. The economy seems to like it."
"Anyway," Sherman sat up in his comfortable chair. It was time to change subjects. Sam's time was valuable, too, as he wanted his guest to appreciate.
"You didn't come here for small talk. What can I do for you, Mr. Secretary?"
"Russia." Sherman's eyes changed a little, as they might when the last card was laid in a high-stakes game of stud.
"What about it?"
"You have a high-powered exploration team working with the Russians. They find anything nice?"
"George, that's sensitive stuff you're asking. If you were still running Columbus, this would constitute insider trading information stuff. Hell, I can't buy any more of our stock now based on this stuff."
"Does that mean you'd like to?" Trader asked with a smile.
"Well, it'll be public soon enough anyway." "Yeah, George, looks like we've found the biggest goddamned oil field ever. Bigger in the Persian Gulf. Bigger in Mexico. Damn sight bigger than Prudhoe Bay and Western Canada combined. I'm talking big, billions and billions of barrels of what looks like the very best light sweet crude just sitting there and waiting for us to pump it out of the tundra. It's a field we'll measure in years of production, not just barrels."
"Bigger than the PG?"
Sherman nodded. "By a factor of 40%, and that's a very conservative number. The only beef is where it is. Getting that crude out is going to be a mother humper. To get started, anyway. We're talking $20 billion just for the pipeline. It'll make Alaska look like a kindergarten project. But it'll be worth it."
"And your end of it?" the Secretary of the Treasury asked. That question generated a frown.
"We're negotiating that now. The Russians seem to want to pay us a flat consulting fee, like $1 billion a year. They're talking a lot less than that now, but you know how the hog trading works at this stage, right? They say a couple of $100 million, but they mean $1 billion a year, for 7 to 10 years, I'd imagine. And that isn't bad for what we'd have to do for the money. But I want a minimum of 5% of the find. And that's not at all an unreasonable request on our part. They have some good people in the geology business, but nobody in the world can sniff out oil and ice like my people can. And they've got a lot to learn about how to exploit something like this. We've been there and done that in these environmental conditions. Ain't nobody knows this like we do, even the guys at BP. And they're pretty good. But we're the best in the world, George. That's the barrel we have them over. They can do it without us, but with us helping, they'll make a ton more cash, and a hell of a lot faster. And they know that. And we know they know that. So I got my lawyers talking to their lawyers. Actually, they have diplomats doing the negotiating. Sherman managed a grin. They're dumber than my lawyers. Winston nodded. Texas turned out more good private practice attorneys than most parts of America. And the excuse was that in Texas, there were more men needin' killin' than horses needin' stealin'. And the oil business paid the best. And in Texas, like every place else, talent went where the money was. When will this go public? The Russians are trying to keep a cork in it. One of the things we're getting from our lawyers is that they're worried about how to exploit this one. Really, who to keep out of it, you know, their mafia and stuff. They do have some serious corruption problems over there, and I can sympathize. Winston knew he could ignore the next part. The oil industry did business all over the world, dealing with corruption on the small scale, $10 million or less, or even the monstrous scale, $10 billion or more, was just part of the territory for such companies as Sam Sherman ran. And the United States government had never probed too deeply into that. Though there were federal statutes governing how American companies handled themselves abroad, many of those laws were selectively enforced, and this was merely one such example. Even in Washington, business was business. "And so they're trying to keep it quiet until they can make the proper arrangements," Sherman concluded. "You hearing anything else?" "What do you mean?" Sherman asked in reply. "Any other geological windfalls?" Winston clarified. "No, I'm not that greedy in what I pray for. George, I haven't made it clear enough just how huge this oil field is. It's..." "Relax, Sam. I can add and subtract with the best of them," Sectrez assured his host. "Something I need to know about?" Sherman only saw hesitation. "Give and take, George. I played fair with you, remember?" "Gold," Winston clarified. "How much?" "They're not sure. South Africa, at least. Maybe more."
"Really?
Well, that's not my area of expertise, but sounds like our Russian friends are having a good year for a change." "Good for them," Sherman thought.
"You like them?"
"Yeah, as a matter of fact. They're a lot like Texans. They make good friends and fearsome enemies. They know how to entertain, and Jesus, do they know how to drink. About time they got some good luck. Christ knows they've had a lot of the other kind. This is going to mean a lot for their economy, and damn near all of it's going to be good news. Especially if they can handle the corruption stuff and keep the money inside their borders where it'll do them some good, instead of finding its way onto some Swiss bank's computer. That new mafia they have over there is smart and tough, and a little scary. They just got somebody I knew over there."
"Really? Who was that, Sam?"
"We called him Grisha. He took care of some high rollers in Moscow. Knew how to do it right. He was a good name to know if you had some special requirements," Sherman allowed. Winston recorded the information in his mind for later investigation.
"Killed him?" Sherman nodded.
Yep, blew him away with a bazooka right there on the street. It made CNN, remember?
The TV news network had covered it as a crime story with no further significance except for its dramatic brutality. A story gone and forgotten in a single day. George Winston vaguely remembered it and set it aside.
How often you go over there? Not too often. Twice this year. Usually hop my G5 over direct out of Reagan or Dallas-Fort Worth. Long flight, but it's a one hop.
No, I haven't seen the new oil field yet. Expect I'll have to in a few months, but I'll try for decent weather.
Boy, you don't know what cold means till you go that far north in the winter. Thing is, it's dark then, so you're better off waiting till summer anyway. But at best you can leave the sticks at home. Ain't no golf at all in that part of the world, George.
So take a rifle and bag yourself a bear. Make a nice rug, Winston offered.
Gave that up. Besides, I got 3 polar bears. That one is number 8 in the Boone and Crockett all-time book,
Sherman said, pointing to a photo on the far wall.
Sure enough, it showed a hell of a big polar bear. I've made 2 kids on that rug, the president of Atlantic Richfield observed with a sly smile.
The pelt in question lay before his bedroom fireplace in Aspen, Colorado, where his wife liked to ski in the winter.
Why'd you give it up? My kids think there aren't enough polar bears anymore. All that ecology shit they learn in school now.
Yeah, Sec Trez said sympathetically. And they do make such great rugs.
Right, well, that rug was threatening some of our workers up at Prudhoe Bay back in 75, as I recall. And I took him at 60 yards with my .338 Winchester.
One shot, the Texan assured his guest.
I suppose nowadays you have to let the bear kill a human being, and then all you're supposed to do is just cage him and transport him to another location so the bear doesn't get too traumatized, right?
Sam, I'm Secretary of the Treasury. I leave the birds and bees to EPA. I don't hug trees, not until they turn the wood chips into T-bills, anyway.
A chuckle. Sorry, George. I'm always hearing that stuff at home. Maybe it's Disney. All wild animals wear white gloves and talk to each other in good Midwestern Iowa English.
Cheer up, Sam. At least they're laying off the supertankers out of Valdez now. How much of the Eastern Alaska-Western Canada strike is yours?
Not quite half, but that'll keep my stockholders in milk and cookies for a long time.
So, between that one and Siberia, how many options will they give you to exercise? Sam Sherman got a nice salary. But at his level, the way you earned your keep was measured in the number of options in the stock whose value your work had increased, invariably offered you by the board of directors, whose own holdings you inflated in value through your efforts.
A knowing smile and a raised eyebrow. A lot, George. Quite a lot.
Married life agrees with you, Andrea. President Ryan observed with a smile at his principal agent. She was dressing better, and there was a definite spring in her step now. He wasn't sure if her skin had a new glow or maybe her makeup was just different. Jack had learned never to comment on a woman's makeup. He always got it wrong.
You're not the only one to say that, sir.
One hesitates to say such things to a grown adult female, especially if you're fashion-bereft as I am, Jack said, his smile broadening somewhat. His wife, Kathy, still said she had to dress him because his taste was entirely, she said, in his mouth.